Welcome to In the Clear, Community Learning Exchange Advocacy Radio, with your hosts, Dr. John A. Oliver and Willie Anderson.
This is an interview with Daryl Scott, professor at Howard University and presiding president of ASALA, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. He's presenting his views on respectability politics. I had an opportunity to sit with him and chat. And here is an excerpt from the interview.
Okay, my name is Daryl Michael Scott. I'm professor of history at Howard University, where I teach U.S. history since 1865, and I'm the president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, ASALA, founded by Carter G. Woodson in 1915, and we're celebrating our centennial meeting.
What are your duties as president?
Well, you know, as president of an association, I am the first and foremost the spokesperson of the organization, but my real duty is always in such not-for-profit organizations is to make sure that we stay within the 501c3 charter that we have, that we live up to our mission, which is to create and disseminate knowledge about Black life, culture, and history. And so I'm really charged with making sure that we do those things. My own work has to do with several things. And the latest project I'm working on is actually a history of respectability politics that will take it from the 1780s all the way till the present. So it's a long-term history of what the youth of today like to derisively call the belief that respectability will transform the position of Black folks in America.
Respectability politics, what is that?
Well, respectability politics is in fact the belief held by many that if individual African Americans were to adhere to middle class values of behavior and conduct, that they would in fact not be the victims of police violence, that they would have greater economic opportunities within the society, and that they could find their way into the middle class.
What's the tension with that particular approach or belief about respectability politics? Or is there? Maybe I should ask
it
that way.
Well, there is a tension because what some would argue is that no matter how respectable you are, you will still be a victim of racism, whether at the hands of the police or someone who has the opportunity to employ people. So that respectability will not save you from the same fate as everybody else in society. The flip side of that typically is that Black people, even if they're, respectability will not necessarily make you equal and free, but it is a precondition. Mm-hmm. For one's equality. That's been the counterpoint ever since this notion of respectability came along.
How long have you been working on it?
Well, actually, it's kind of an interesting question. My first paper in graduate school was entitled The Cult of Respectability, which I wrote in the fall of 1986. Actually, it was probably the spring of 86.
So you've been working on that in multiple decades now.
No, I mean, I've been a student of it for that long. It was a project that I did in graduate school and put it aside. I never thought I would write a book about it. But within the last 3 years, everywhere you turn, you see this as part and parcel of the debate surrounding Black Lives Matters and other efforts that Black people have to get justice for people, such as Trayvon Martin. So once again, Trayvon with the hoodie.
Right.
And some people would say if Trayvon had dressed respectably, i.e. had not worn a hoodie, he would be alive today.
Mm-hmm.
And others would say his hoodie has nothing to do with his death.
Right.
And so this is, and people started talking about this in terms of respectability politics, which comes out of a work by, ironically, the incoming president of the association, Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham. She published on this topic first. So my paper was a graduate paper. She actually wrote the book where the students learned the concept from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my effort, on one hand, it's an intellectual enterprise to show the younger generation, and hopefully for them to learn in school, that this problem is not a new problem, that it's not a problem that even goes back to the 1890s simply. Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham's book is on the 1890s.
What's her book title?
Righteous Discontent.
Okay.
And Righteous Discontent has a chapter called The Politics of Respectability. And a lot of people who've taken her course or read her book, I should say, are of the opinion that it is the beginning of respectability politics. But the 1890s was just one moment in the long history of respectability politics that goes all the way back to the late 18th century.
Is there anything that I haven't asked that you would like for us to cover or share that you, before we close the segment?
I'd like to get the listeners to understand that almost everything that we do has a historical antecedent, that it comes out of somewhere, and that the problems that black people confront today are sometimes part of a stream of problems that have been flowing in our community since time immemorial. In this particular case, there's always been this tension that has existed between adhering to values that some associate with human dignity, and even though they're really just middle class values, but some people invest those values with human dignity, because some of them include things like cleanliness, okay?
Right.
And some of them include things such as being sanitary. So this whole respectability notion includes a lot. And that these ideas are there for, some people would argue, for human dignity, versus the advocacy of these ideas as a panacea for the problems that black people face.
Okay.
And it's not really an either or proposition. They are both for, quite often, human dignity. And by the way, and then part of what I want to argue for the younger generation is that anybody who has a value code, any code of values, amounts to a set of ideals that you're saying people should subscribe to, and those people who do are the ones that we treat as respectable people, so that any group of people with ideals and beliefs have a concept of respectability.
Mm-hmm.
To see a group of people without one is to see a group of people for whom anything goes.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
So I close my segments by asking those whom to share one or two songs that could accompany the segment itself. And I love to see that face, that response. Like, I could talk about my research and what I'm doing. You caught me off guard, brother. So one or two songs.
I mean,
songs.
It's interesting. I can't name the song, but one could just simply play the track to Bill Cosby's movie, the Bill Cosby Show, because that is almost, the show is emblematic of what respectability politics are all about.
So you're going to add another 10 minutes. Now, how is that?
Well, the Bill Cosby Show really
now, we're just talking the show, not the current situation that he's in.
Well, we could talk both of them, right? I mean, the show itself was a celebration of black middle class life and what becomes of people who live a respectable existence, right? And so Theo and the other kids and mother and the father, they're all successful black people because they all carry themselves a certain way in a very respectable manner, right? According to middle class standards. And then we turn around and we see a guy who was living a life that contradicted the image that he portrayed on screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nothing's more disreputable than rape, right? And sexual assault. So if in fact, I mean, to the extent that all these allegations are grounded in truth, then the hypocrisy that he lived versus what he represented in his art is just as stark as anything we've ever seen.
Yeah, right.
Right. And so the Bill Cosby soundtrack is the soundtrack of respectability, and should we say the sound of this, its new silence, and the fact that it's been yanked is if you will, the soundtrack of his disreputable behavior, right?
Mm. You're listening to In the Clear, Community Learning Exchange Advocacy Radio. I'm your host, the good brother, Dr. Oliver, in the absence of my co-host, Ms. Willie Sue Anderson. And this show is covering respectability politics. The interview just covered the perspectives of Dr. Daryl Scott, professor at Howard University and presiding president of ASALA, the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History. In his views, he shared his understanding of what respectability politics is, the historical context, and he applied it to today's context. What I'd like to do is to bring it a little bit closer to home. So with the idea of acting a certain way to receive a certain behavior or a certain level of privilege, a certain level of treatment is part of respectability politics. So some would say if you act, if you dress, if you speak, if you look, if you behave in a certain manner or fashion, then you will be afforded the privileges and the rights that are afforded to the rest of society, especially those who are a part of mainstream culture in a mainstream community, especially for those who are part of marginalized groups and Black Americans in particular. The problem with that is individuals have adhered to those values and those beliefs and those behaviors, and they've still received unjust treatment. They've still received excessive force. They've still even lost their lives as they were living respectably. Now, in his segment, Dr. Scott closes with a narrative on the current situation that Bill Cosby is involved in. Now, he points out that for decades, Bill Cosby was the quintessential example of respectability politics, of proper behavior, of achieving and doing everything that would lift a community, lift a race. While behind closed doors, the accusations are coming that he behaved in a completely different manner. Now, the respectability politics would add that he should receive the same treatment as those who are a part of mainstream society and culture and hold those values. So as a person who's in the industry, who has a level of status, prestige, fame, money, philanthropic endeavors, educational attainment, community involvement, is he receiving the same treatment that others would receive? Should he receive that treatment, or should everyone else just receive the treatment that he is receiving? The thing is, there's questions, and it's not a matter of deciding, is he right or wrong? That's not what I'm looking to do. What I am trying to do is ask the questions, to pose the question, to provide a space for others to ask questions. It's not a pointing the finger, it's more of an open hand inviting a conversation. What happens when you live a life that is respectable, but you still don't receive the treatment that that life of living respectably is supposed to receive according to the values that they adhere to? Let's move it away from Bill Cosby and let's look at our young people, our students. Most recently, there is a viral video of an incident that happened in a high school in South Carolina, where you see the young person is sitting in their desk. You see an adult who appears to be an officer knock the desk over, throw the child over that's still in the desk, you know, backwards. And then as the child's on the floor, still in the desk, grabbing the child, which appears to be by her neck or throat area, and pulling her out of the desk and dragging across the floor out of the room. Now, of course, everyone, you need to know the whole story. You need to know what happened. You need to know what was all involved. We understand that. But the point is, even if that student was insubordinate, even if that student was out of line with quotes, was the treatment fair? Was it equitable? Was it just? Was it excessive? What about those students who are in the classroom who had to witness that? Those are the ones who were doing their lessons, who were doing what they're supposed to be, though, we presume, but they still had to witness that traumatic experience of a classmate at the hands of someone in authority within their school. So we send our students to school to learn. We also send them there to be in a safe environment, and that environment should be conducive enough for them to make mistakes, but still learn from them. Now, some would say, well, she learned a lesson. But is that the lesson that we want our young people to learn? Do we want them to live in fear of authority? Do we want others to look around and say, well, as long as it's not me, or I'm glad that's not me? Or do we want to have an easy way out to say, well, if you did A, B, and C, if you did not respond insubordinately, if you were not in defiance, then these things wouldn't have happened to you? But with all of that, there's still due process. There's still protocols and policies and procedures in place that we are required to follow and adhere to. Even in the most adverse situations, there is still a roadmap of sorts to follow. And based on some of the instances that we're seeing unfold before our eyes, these individuals are not following what we ascribe to as a proper response. And so therein, another incident in a high school in Texas, in the Round Rock area, where a young man was involved in an altercation with another student. And as a result of that, the school administrators and the campus police were called. Now, in this viral video, we see a young man who's in conversation with two officers. One is in close proximity, the other is off to the side. And at some point in the dialogue or the conversation, if we just take away the wording, without the audio and look at the body language, we see that the young man is expressing himself with his hands. The officer is also expressing himself with his hands. At some point, the officer and the student come in contact. It appears that the student pushed the officer's hand away or tried to walk away. We don't know. I don't know. I'm just laying out this idea of respectability politics and behavior and what is acceptable. And I'm framing it in a way where if it's happening with our young people and we're teaching them, you do A, B, and C, 1, 2, and 3, and you will be okay. But we see that even in those situations, them deviating outside of that line, do they receive the treatment that is acceptable? And in those situations, we would agree that there are some questions that need to be answered. There are some answers that need to be understood. And that's both to the students and to the adults. Now, I put a little more responsibility on the adult because we know what happens with young people. We know what happens with students, with children. There is a moment when they are defiant, where they are clumsy in expressing themselves, where they are out of touch with their emotions. They're going through these hormonal changes where sometimes they can't necessarily control that behavior as well as they will be able to when they become adults. And so in those situations, that environment should be conducive enough for them to make those mistakes without it being harmful and even detrimental to their health and their lives. So seeing these two young people and then having the extremes of Trayvon, as Daryl Scott laid out, having the extreme of Tamir Rice in Ohio. Children. Now, we like to frame it as young adults and young people. These were children who were acted upon by an adult. So in any situation, the onus is on the adult. And that's part of what we have to ask. So even if we tell our children to pull up their pants, to dress appropriately, to have a certain hairstyle, or not have a hairstyle, then they will receive certain treatment. And we see that, well, those are what we believe. Those are the values that we believe. But if it comes across as we don't want it to be detrimental to the race or to the community, then that's where it becomes problematic. Now, this is not new to the community. It's been around, as we heard, you know, since the mid-1800s. And it continues to resurface in different ways. And as a community, we have to ask the question. We have to be prepared for the answers. We have to be willing to provide an answer so that we can understand this phenomena at a greater capacity. Respectability politics. This is a good brother, Dr. Oliver. You're listening to In the Clear, Community Learning Exchange Advocacy Radio. And I'm here in the absence of my co-host, Ms. Willie Sue Anderson. So what is it that, what happened? Where are the adults? Where is the outrage? Where is the protests? Where is the organizing? Where is the marches? Where is the boycott? Where are the questions? Where are the testimonies at city council meetings and school board meetings and meetings with the principal? Where are our leaders to speak truth to power? So there's a song that Wynton Marsalis has on one of his albums. It's called From the Plantation to the Penitentiary. And one of his songs is entitled, Where Y'all At? I'm gonna play it for you. But before I play it, he lays out this narrative that asks and that speaks to those who were the leaders at a particular time. And now, when we need them to lead, he's asking, where are you? Where y'all at? How can we stand by and allow these things to continue to happen to our children? How can we stand by and allow these things to happen within our communities and not ask questions and wait for the answer? Not ask questions and then go away and wait. No, we ask questions and we wait right there for the answer. And as we wait, we will call those who are in our social networks. We'll call in the social capital, community capital, and we will wait. We'll put the pressure on the individuals who are at the forefront, who are supposed to be leading, who are supposed to be protecting, who are supposed to be learning. So students are not off the hook. That's not what we're doing. But what I am suggesting is that we have to be in conversation. We can't shy away from the situation because it's uncomfortable. We can't shy away from it because we've made progress. And let's just move on. No, we have not made the progress that we should have made for this thing to be in existence for as long as it has. We live in a different time, a different era, where the behaviors of individuals is no longer tolerated. For example, students who misbehave, children who misbehave, once upon a time, they would be disciplined from the spot of their misbehavior all the way home, and each person that they came in contact would be allowed to contribute in some way their comments or even their correction, even sometimes that correction being physical. And it was accepted. It was expected at some points. And we use the phrase, it takes a village to raise the child. But what happens when our village is not healthy, mentally, physically, psychologically? What happens when those individuals are not a part of the system of understanding and the value system that we share? What happens if they're abusive? What happens when they're excessive? Do we still expect that that individual will be a part of raising our child? Is that what we mean? It takes a village? Now, we know that there's a phrase, the village idiot. So are we allowing the village idiot to have that role? Are we allowing the village abuser to have that role, that place in raising our children without correcting it, without holding them accountable, without expelling them from the community itself? Now, we're going to check our children. We're going to do the things that are required to hold them accountable. We've been doing that for years, for decades, centuries, I would even say, teaching our young people how to survive so that they can come home. There was a recent forum where a police chief mentioned something that his father taught him. The phrase was, you can get out of jail, but you can't get out of the cemetery. So in other words, having that conversation with those in authority or those who are in power or those who are seeking to do harm or who are doing harm, that's not the time to have the conversation. So be quiet and do what you're asked. Acquiesce, follow directions. We still see that even in those situations where individuals did acquiesce and follow directions, they were still excessively handled, and then sometimes they even lost their lives. So we need to have the question up front now, before those situations occur, before those individuals are in the streets in need of a conversation because of what they were taught. We need to have that conversation now. We need to hold people accountable now. We'll close out the segment with Wynton Marsalis. Where y'all at? You're listening to Community Learning Exchange Advocacy Radio, bringing the CLE to your ear. This is KAZI-FM, and this is a good brother, Dr. Oliver, in the absence of my co-host, Ms. Willie Sue Anderson. This is In the Clear. Thank you for listening.
Speak the language the people are speaking, especially when you see the havoc is wreaking. Even the rap game started out critiquing. Now it's all about killing and freaking. All you 60s radicals and world beaters, righteous revolutionaries, Camus readers, liberal students, equal rights pleaders, what's going on now that y'all are the leaders?
Where y'all at?
Your nose, it's us that's thinking. It all can't be blamed on the party of Lincoln. The left and the right got the country sinking. Knock the scales from justice hands and set our eyes to blinking. Patriots, compatriots and true blue believers, brilliant thinkers, overachievers. All you, when I was young, we were so naive. Y'all started like Eldridge and now you're like Beaver.
Where y'all at?
And pride. We got scared after King and the Kennedys died. Corruption and graft, and we taking stride. Sitting around like owls, talking about, ooh, who lied? All you poor folks, victims of rich folks' gains. Rich folks, y'all get ripped off in the same name. All you gossips cackling about a dirty shame. Whistleblowers crying about who's to blame.
Where y'all at?
I said, where y'all at? about the black and it ain't about the white. They'll both get together to make your pocket light. When you just keep on paying and paying, do your jaws get tight? Taxes, that's your real inalienable right. You Afro-wares and barbershop experts, conspiracy theorists and political disconcerts, big bang pants wears with the long white t-shirts, the good man to counter with the bad man asserts.
When y'all
ready to love us. Now everybody can't wait to rub us. We're running all over the world with a blunderbuss and the Constitution all but forgotten the fuss. And brothers, fathers and mothers, I guess you'd pimp your daughters if you had your brothers. All you is not me, it's always others. You watch the crime, you close your shutters. Folks watching Fox and CNN News seeking a cure for the red, white and blues. Well, it won't matter which side you choose if we end up paying international dues. In my day, it used to be fraud.
You're listening to 88.7 FM KAZI Austin. This is In the Clear, Community Learning Exchange Advocacy Radio, with your host, the good brother Dr. Oliver, in the absence of my co-host, Ms. Willie Sue Anderson. You are now in the clear. Have a good day.